It's time for another installment of Dig Deep. Today we're taking up the conversation about healthcare. Who better to be a part of that but Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator from Minnesota Brown, and Chuck Marone. He is our conservative commentator, CEO, founder of Strong Towns. Welcome to the studios.
Glad to be here.
Thanks.
Here we go again.
Thanks so much for having us.
Line them up. We're ready to go.
All right.
We arm wrestled for half an hour after the last one.
That's right.
So this isn't exactly the same kind of topic, but I think we start in a similar place. We start with the past. How has healthcare changed? What did it used to be? What has it become?
You can trace it back to through American history. Let's just say, where did America's healthcare system come from? And like a lot of the world, 200 years ago, you had a doctor, and that was your healthcare system. The doctor lived in your town, and you would pay the doctor for his services. If he was a generous man, he would help people who couldn't afford it as much, and this was how healthcare was delivered for a very long time. And then as you got into larger cities and towns, you know, hospitals would form, cities would form hospitals, private churches would form hospitals, and this was how healthcare was conducted for a long time. Keep in mind that this is the time in history when a lot of people died for a lot of reasons that they don't die now. And so as healthcare developed, I think that our modern system, as I was reading up for this show and go back to the industrialization of America and start to see as this goes on that workers, just like they were forming unions and collective bargaining units, as we would now call them, they were also forming collectives related to healthcare. And one of the most interesting examples I found was right here in northern Minnesota. And we've actually had Sarah Breeze, an actress and a teacher from Bemidji, has a one-woman show she's done on Sister Amata, the nun who would visit the logging camps of early northern Minnesota history. And what she would show with this real-life person is that this nun would visit the logging camps, and what she was essentially doing was getting the loggers to put a quarter or some money into a collective, a pool, and it was essentially a health insurance pool. And the loggers then, if they got hurt on the job, which was very common, would be able to go to town and get medical care by making a claim against this pool. It was essentially an insurance thing, and it was done really as an act of Christian charity and as something to help these workers who were being maimed left and right as part of the working conditions of the time. And you can kind of start to see how that was done on a charitable basis with the idea of helping people, and it kind of developed from there. As unions and workers gained more power, we've talked about that before, they started demanding more. And this is where in the early 20th century, you started to see modern insurance plans as we now know them come together.
You had this transition from guilds and fraternities and, you know, social orders. I'm a Catholic. I think the Knights of Columbus actually back in the day was like this way to help poor people in need, you know, people who were sick. You saw this transition to what is this modern mess that we have around World War II. In World War II, you were not increasing, most of the young men were gone off fighting a war. They were part of the military machine, and people needed laborers, and you weren't increasing wages at that point. So what companies would do would say, we can't increase your wages, but we can give you this side benefit. And the side benefit is this healthcare stipend. And ultimately, the government stepped in the 40s and said, you know, okay, we'll allow that to be tax deductible. And very soon then, after World War II, you had unions asking for this as part of their negotiation. Companies were happy to do this because it kept wages down and it was a tax deductible fringe benefit. So what you wound up with by the time you got to the Medicare, Medicaid era, where we started having that conversation, is a precedent where your ability to get, and at that point it was insurance, not health coverage. You still were expected to pay for most of your day-to-day stuff out of your pocket. But if a calamity happened, you would have insurance. That was now an employer-based benefit. And so the relationship between employee and employer was kind of cemented with this need for healthcare. And of course, that was easier to do in the business models we had in the 50s and 60s, where, like my grandpa said, you'd get a job and you'd work at the factory for life. It was more of a long-term commitment on both sides, where that kind of made a lot of sense.
Well, it was the peak of the labor movement. It was when a large part of the country worked in union negotiated contract environments, and that's where these health plans were strongest and best. And so people would seek out jobs because of the great benefits packages at the time, and then stick at the job for a long time because it was great. You know, they got a pension, they got health insurance, they got everything that they needed. You know, they didn't have to worry about it. And that was the whole selling point of it.
And not to be too geeky, but I'm going to talk about population pyramids just for a second.
Oh, boy.
I kind of feel compelled to do this. It's the idea that, like, how many young people do we have versus how many old people? And this was a period of time where we started in the 60s, Medicare, Medicaid, healthcare for the elderly and for the poor. And then we started Social Security in the, earlier than that. But when you look at the population, the ratio of young people to elderly people was quite favorable for the math to work. We had this baby boom that was, you know, this huge outpouring of love and affection mm-hmm. after World War II that resulted in all these little children running around, and they were now all at working age and paying taxes and being very productive. And so you had this huge amount of wealth that we yeah. were experiencing as a country. And it made it very easy to say, look, wow, we're affluent. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we take care of the elderly? Shouldn't we take care of poor people? And it became kind of an easier sell because it really wasn't a lot of sacrifice.
It's Dig Deep on 91.7 KEXE, 90.5 KBXE. Chuck Marone there, our conservative commentator from Strong Towns. Aaron Brown continues the conversation about the past of healthcare. He's our liberal commentator from Minnesota Brown.
The other thing that was really big here is the advance in medical science that happened kind of simultaneously, because, you know, I'm doing some research on early Iron Range history, 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. And in the 1920s, these two, Mayor Victor Power and Hibbing, this great historical figure on the Iron Range, he kicked off at age 45 from some basic heart problems.
Did you just say kicked off?
Kicked off. I'm sorry. He expired.
He assumed room temperature at age 45.
He expired. And I'm sorry, that's terrible. But at the same,
I thought he was taking like an ocean voyage or something. But you just go like, he kicked off. Like, what? Like, okay.
I misspoke. At the same time, the local superintendent of the Oliver Mining Company, one of his adversaries, allies and adversaries over the years of political finagling, also died from some what we would now call treatable conditions. This was in the 20s. The Depression happens, World War II happens, these advances in science, especially things like penicillin, the ability to treat infections that would have killed people, the ability to save women who would have died in childbirth, and then extending the life of people. So this all started happening, and then it became a question of, now that we have all this science, who deserves to get it? Well, everybody wants to live. Everybody wants to survive having some heart problems, you know, and there's surgeries and things that we take as common as everyday kinds of things now that were not everyday things maybe 60, 70 years ago. So all of this was happening. People were living longer and becoming healthier and stronger and better fed, and all these things that weren't a guarantee 100 years ago are now everyday life with this, you know, the suburbanization of America. As people move out and become more affluent, there's more wealth, that people are living longer. The point is that all becomes more expensive, and these insurance policies that were attached to all these jobs became even more important. I think it's important to point out, you expect this, but at the same time, right after World War II, that's when you see a lot of other industrialized economies around the world take a different direction with their health care. Part of that is because I think World War II had a much bigger effect on a lot of the European countries in terms of infrastructure, in terms of wealth and health, and, you know, people were just, the whole cities were devastated in ways that I don't think American cities really understood. And there was less wealth at the time in some of these countries because of the war. And so you saw single-payer universal systems, government run systems come out of England and a lot of European countries and other places around the world at the same time. United States did not take that route, and were many times offered that route by different political leaders and always rejected it. In fact, it's been rejected. It's like the cicadas. It comes up every however many years cicadas come out of the ground, 17, one of those, and 12, oh boy. And it comes up again, and it's gotten close at times. I think in the mid-70s it was pretty close because Richard Nixon was opening the door to it. But it never quite got there. And part of that, I think, has to do with the wealth of the United States of America, the fact that a majority of Americans did have a system that was providing them this miraculous care. And people were living longer and things were going well. Nobody wanted to give that up.
Let me put an exclamation point on something that Aaron brought up, and that is the cost structure. When I say this population pyramid, I'm talking about a whole bunch of young people paying for a smaller subset of elderly people. And when you look at the care they were providing, the miracle drugs of the time were penicillin. They were things that actually are fairly cheap and affordable by modern standards. They weren't some drug cocktail that you had to take multiple times a day. They weren't, in-home intensive treatments. You actually had families living together that did that as a basic course of day-to-day life. You didn't have long-term hospitalization. There were a lot of things that at the time were not considered standard care. And the stuff that was considered revolutionary was actually pretty darn affordable and cheap. My dad had polio. He's one of the last people to ever get polio. He was born, I want to say, in 51 or 52. We vaccinated everybody. It was a huge revolution and advancement. Dirt cheap to do, in comparison. So you look, I remember when I was in grade school and they had the first artificial heart. Do you remember the guy's name? I don't remember his name, but I remember the stories in Time magazine, and it was, in our weekly reader at school about the guy who had, and he stayed alive for like 90 days, and it was this miracle. He had this like rotor machine as a heart, and it was this huge revolution in thinking like, oh my gosh, could someday we be able to replace hearts, and could someday we keep people alive? And now like a pacemaker is a routine thing. A brand new titanium knee is a routine thing. A new set of hips, a new, all these things that not only are far more intensive, but a lot more expensive, have become under the guise of routine medicine. At the same time, that population pyramid has inverted and has now become one where you have a far smaller subset of younger people that are being expected to pay for much more expansive and extensive treatments for elderly people.
His name was Barney Clark.
Barney Clark, thank you. I remember being deeply inspired by that story at the time. And you would get home every day and you'd turn on the news to see if he was still alive, mm-hmm. to see if he had cast off or whatever the...
Kicked off.
Kicked off. The term. Yeah,
did he get kicked off the okay. island or not? I remember Jarvik. That was the name of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking that was his name, but...
No, thank you for the science back. I just remember being deeply inspired by that and mm-hmm. thinking, wow, we've entered this beautiful new world where like everything seems possible. And I think, today as we sit on the edge of this kind of genetics revolution, where, theoretically it's going to be possible to customize drug regimes to people and different very complex treatments, we're looking at exponentially increasing costs with a minimal pool of resources and players to pay for that stuff.
And it's no secret that cost in healthcare now is so heavily weighed on the last period of a person's life. The last few years of your life, you're going to cost more to take care of than perhaps the rest of your life all inclusive. So as people are living longer, and again, what's the alternative? This is the part that nobody wants. So if you have these treatments, why wouldn't you use them? And as a result, the costs go higher. And so these simple insurance pools, the nun in the logging camp collecting quarters from the loggers in case they get cut or fall off a tree, these things have been swamped. They become these huge organisms. And of course, many times now private companies sitting in people's 401ks with demands for profit and growth. like all the rest of America's corporate landscape. And so that becomes a big complicating factor. And at the same time, you have the hospitals and healthcare providers becoming much more complex for a lot of the same reasons. Huge networks of hospitals. Right now, your local rural clinics are usually operated by a larger system from somewhere else, and they have many, many places just like that that they run, and a whole set of administrative costs that come with that. And with all of that taken together, Americans don't know what things cost, and we don't know who pays for them, and we don't know what $1 spent on our premiums or $1 spent on our copays or any dollar that we put into the healthcare system through our taxes or through our private insurance. We don't exactly know where all that money goes. And you'll hear different stories from different corners of the market and the political sphere as you try to figure this out. It's one of the reasons why it's a vexing issue, and it's vexed both parties for a long time.
As we wed ourselves to this employer-employee model back in the post-war period, as we got into the 80s and the 90s, what you saw were businesses that had a substantial number of employees, 100, 200 employees, would generally self-insure. They wouldn't send money to an insurance company. They would collect money from people, and they would keep that aside, and they would pay for their own employees. It was basically like, we're all going to pool together and help whoever gets sick. And then all of a sudden, you know, a lot of these businesses would see someone would have to have a liver replacement or someone would get cancer. And you were starting to get people at that age mm-hmm. where that became a more prevalent thing. And those things would just sink these plans really quick. And so during the 90s, you saw the rise of the PPO, the HMO started to come into effect, and you started to see businesses transition from being self-employed to saying, we can't take this risk. Yep. We're going to shop this out to someone else who can. And you get, a further separation from the people who are getting the care, from the people who are deciding what that care would be. And so we entered this kind of very strange world, not by choice. And I've heard this said by people on the right and on the left. If we were to step back and say, let's design the most like messed up, convoluted, expensive, low quality healthcare system we could, I don't think we could intentionally come up with one that was more that way than the one we've created.
We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world by far, not even close. And
the next one's like half.
Yeah.
Like half the cost of it. We spend 17% of GDP, and I want to say Australia's like 9%, and they're the next highest.
Right. It's a vast amount of money, and a whole sector of the economy kind of wrapped up in it, almost like a parasite. It's just the veins and the tendrils of the thing are all intertwined, and so operate on it, to use a medical tie-in, is very difficult because of this strange relationship between an individual and their medical health care that started around World War II, and plus the tied to the employer, people making decisions about where they work and whether or not they do things like start a business based on health care. That's all something that's a product of the, I don't even know if it was a choice so much as what occurred after the Depression and World War II.
I think maybe as like a concluding thought too, it's really important, I think, as we sit here today, to point out that our relationship, employee-employer relationship, is dramatically different today than it was when this entire system kind of started to evolve. People switch jobs more. There's more part-time workers. There are more independent contractors, in a sense. There are fewer factory jobs and union jobs of the traditional sense. And so that contract that we essentially based everything on, the idea that employee-employer would work together to do this, is completely obsolete today. It's not a viable model.
This is Dig Deep. We're talking healthcare. In our next segment, we'll dig more into some of the biggest issues involving healthcare right now. And in our final installment, we'll look at reform.